In Matthew 11, verses 25 and 26, Jesus finishes up chapter 11 by making a statement. It says, "At that time, Jesus said, 'I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you have hidden these things from the wise and intelligent and have revealed them to infants. Yes, Father, for this way was well-pleasing in your sight.'" That statement in Matthew 11, 25 and 26 is a response to something. It's a response to what happened earlier in the chapter. That's why it begins with the statement, "at that time." That is, after all of these things that we've looked at in chapter 11, Jesus said that. And that context of that time of chapter 11 makes this statement absolutely remarkable. And I might also add that it makes what you did tonight in being here quite remarkable. Because it really is a remarkable thing that anybody has faith. It is a very remarkable thing that in this world, with all of the distractions and then all of the pain and heartache and troubles and trials and entanglements that sin offers, it is an amazing thing that here in, you know, small town America, right, people choose to serve the Lord. The default should be not to. The default should be that nobody cares. And in fact, that's what Jesus saw in Matthew chapter 11. Jesus' response to say, "Father, I am Father, Lord of heaven and earth, I praise you that you have hidden these things from the wise and intelligent and revealed them to infants. Yes, Father, for this way was well-pleasing in your sight." This is his response to the fact that there's a certain kind of person that obeys the gospel. There's a certain kind of person who gets up in the morning and no matter what life has brought and what difficulties have come, and no matter how many temptations the devil puts before them and allures them with, still chooses God. In Matthew chapter 11, he'd just been rejected by the majority of the cities that he'd preached at. It talks about him preaching in Bethsaida and Capernaum, which were no small cities. They were big cities. They were cities that he spent a great deal of time at. And he said that their response to him was worse than Sodom and Gomorrah, worse than Tyre and Sidon, cities that had long ago been destroyed by God for their godlessness, their faithlessness. So after having seen that many of the places that he went and preached, in general, they just had no interest in the Son of God. And then those who did come, many of them mocked him for associating with John the Baptist. Of course, John the Baptist had come before Jesus. And he had preached out in the wilderness, and there were mixed reviews on John. Some people loved him, and some people hated him. And so those who despised John, they mocked him for being associated with John, for preaching the same message as John. And then the irony of it is that it's in the same chapter he's mocked for not being enough like John. And so Jesus really can't catch a break. The major cities he goes to have no interest in his message. He's too much like John the Baptist for the masses. And then those who follow John say, "Well, you know, you're not enough like John. You know, John was out in the wilderness and he ate locusts and wild honey, and you sit down and you eat and you drink right in the middle of the cities." And Jesus says, "This generation is like children," and he says, "It's like children that." You ask him, "What do you want? Do you want to play a happy song?" And they go, "No, that doesn't sound like fun." He says, "Okay, well, how about a sad song?" "No, we don't want that either." So children that just sit around and are unhappy no matter what you offer, happiness or sorrow. And he says, "You had John and now you had me and you don't want either one." And so at the end of chapter 11, Jesus has had nothing but rejection. That's what I want you to understand about the chapter, is that the vast majority of people that Jesus preached to in Judea, in Galilee, in Samaria, had no interest whatsoever in the message. And then after seeing all of that, instead of hanging his head and feeling sullen and gloomy about it, he gives thanks to God. He says, "God, I praise you. You have a really wonderful plan, Lord, and I see it now." When you think of people who are very successful at life, in any particular endeavor, they seem to have a small little sliver of what Jesus exhibits here, the ability to see the good and even the bad things. You know, it's commonly attributed to Thomas Edison that after inventing the light bulb, he was asked Did he get discouraged after all those attempts and it fails? And he says, I never failed once, but instead I just learned thousands of different ways not to make a light bulb. And so he associated every time he flicked the switch and it burned out the filament, he said, oh, there's one more thing I know that doesn't make a light bulb. It's, you see it in football coaches. They're the great ones are the ones who can just get beat and their team totally and thoroughly defeated, and they get up and they say, hey, we know what we got to work on, so we're ready for the next game. We know we're going to fix. There is this kind of buoyant optimism to see the good in things. And before we progress any farther in the lesson, I want you to realize that is exactly the way Jesus lived his life. He had a very buoyant optimism about him. He was not blind to the weaknesses of man. He wasn't blind to the failings of life or the fact that it was man that would eventually crucify him. It says that he didn't entrust himself to men because he knew what was in them. But on the other hand, he looked at the responses that he had received and said, you know what? This points out something. There is a way that God has made for people to come to him, and it brings out just one type of person. The majority will reject it. But this way that you have revealed the infants and not the wise and intelligent, he says, this way was well-pleasing in your sight. He praised God for it. Scriptures often talk about Christianity in that terminology of the way. Jesus says this way was well-pleasing in your sight. That is, that it is pleasing, the pathway for salvation. And that's what it typically is meant by the way, when Jesus refers to it as the way, or even when Jesus refers to himself as the way. In John 14:6, he says, I am the way and the truth and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through me. God had a particular plan for how people would get to him. And if you compare what Jesus says in John 14:6, where he says, I am that way, and then you compare that to Matthew chapter 11, the reality is the vast majority of people rejected Jesus. And therefore, they rejected God's way to him. And Jesus said, that's not a bad thing. That's actually a good thing. In Acts chapter 9, down in verse 2, the church would be, in its very infancy, referred to as the way. In Acts 9, when Paul wanted to drag Christians off to jail, it says he asked for letters to the synagogues at Damascus so that if he found any belonging to the way, men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. In Acts 18, in verse 25, talking about Apollos, it says he had been instructed in the way of the Lord, and being fervent in spirit, he spoke and taught accurately the things concerning Jesus, though he knew only the baptism of John. It's an interesting statement made about Apollos, that Apollos was a disciple before he was a Christian. He didn't know about baptism yet. He hadn't heard about it. But he was already instructed that there was a way. And we might want to ask ourselves sometimes, are we people that could be said about us, is that we are instructed in the way of the Lord, that we understand God's system for how people come to the Father, that we understand it well enough that we are living it, first of all, and then therefore, because we're living it, we are prepared to make a defense for the hope that is within us. Because there is a way that God has destined all along for people to be saved. There is a way, and Jesus is that way. And Jesus said most people will reject it. So which one are we? Are we going to be the majority? Are we going to be the minority? In Acts chapter 19, verse 23, it says, about that time there arose no little disturbance concerning the way. One of the things that we find as you read through the New Testament, and particularly the book of Acts, as you read about the early church, which was referred to as the way before it was called the Church of Christ, before we see that show up in Romans 16:16, The terminology, earliest terminology for the church was the way. And that language of the way, one of the things that Acts shows you, and particularly pointed out here in Acts 19, verse 23, is that it was a disturbing way. There was a way in which Christ had set his people to live and to share the gospel and bring people to him so that they could go to the Father, they could be saved and go to heaven, and most people found it disturbing. When he says there arose no little disturbance concerning the way in Acts chapter 19, the disturbance was not that there was a problem with Christians internally. The problem was the world's attitude towards Christianity. It was a disturbing idea that was being propagated. And so this way that we are, that we're living by, that we're supposed to share with others, that Jesus himself says, I am, it is a way that is well-pleasing to the Father, but it's also a way that most people will reject. Which is why I say, I mean, just take a moment and realize that what you are doing right here today is a remarkable thing. It's remarkable because most people won't do it. It's remarkable because if you take the vast majority of human beings and you put them in the cesspool that is this world, and it is a cesspool. There are problems and trials and heartaches and sicknesses and difficulties internally in our lives and externally in our lives. And there are temptations that allure instant gratification to remove that, right? A band-aid that never will actually fix your life, but it's a quick fix to give you some sort of gratification. And those are out there rampantly. And the fact that you, as Christians, have made the decision to say, you know what, we will forego those things. We'll forego the pleasures of Egypt, like it says of Moses. Moses, who could have easily had the easy life in Egypt, left those things instead to seek the riches of Christ. That's a remarkable thing. And as much as Moses did it, you do it too. Because you've chosen the well-pleasing way. It's well-pleasing for a couple of different reasons. Jesus says, I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you have hidden these things from the wise and intelligent. It's well-pleasing. The way that God has chosen to save people is well-pleasing because it's hidden from most people. Doesn't that sound odd to you? It's kind of an odd paradigm, isn't it? God's plan to save people through Jesus is a really wonderful plan, that Jesus is the way and that he is the way to the Father and that anybody can be saved from him. One of the great things about that way is that most people will never understand that. Because that's exactly what he says, right? You've hidden these things from the wise and intelligent. That is, the more you steep yourself in this world and you gain the wisdom of this world and the intelligence of this world, the less likely you are to have any interest whatsoever in the gospel of Jesus Christ. And we see that in common sense played out every day, don't we? The higher people go up in academia, what happens to the percentage of Christians? I've said it before, if you get a doctorate in theology, it would be the worst thing you could ever do for your Christianity. Because the guys who have doctorates in theology don't believe that the Bible was written by God. They say it's a really very fascinating ancient document with absolutely no divine essence to it. The guys who write the commentaries that I read, by the way, because they're very well written, they themselves do not actually believe anything that they're writing. Because when you steep yourself in the wisdom and the teaching of this world, your eyes are blinded to Christianity. In Ephesians chapter 8, that should be Ephesians chapter 3. There's no Ephesians chapter 8. Ephesians chapter 3, verses 8 and 9, it says, to preach to the Gentiles the unsearchable riches of Christ and to bring to light for everyone what is the plan of the mystery hidden for ages in God who created all things. The way that God designed salvation was it was originally hidden. When God told Abraham, for those of you in the Wednesday night adult class and we're going through Genesis and you get to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, when God told Abraham to leave his family and leave the country that he was in and go to a place he'd never been before, Abraham was a part of God's great and abiding plan of salvation to bring the Christ in. And Abraham knew nothing about it. Completely blind and ignorant to all of the details of the coming of Jesus. And then Isaac comes along, and guess what? Isaac knew really basically no more than his father did. And then Jacob comes along, and maybe he's given a little bit of details here and there. And then the prophets come along, and the prophets, they come and they speak, and they are given many portions and many little details, but then they search to understand what it is that they're preaching about because they, too, don't really understand what it is that they're talking about. What is this thing that all mankind will be saved in? What is this plan that God has? The gospel has always been a mystery in ages past. But then today we have Christianity, and Christianity is, as Paul says, to bring the light for everyone. What is that plan? That is, During the Old Testament, nobody really knew the whole plan, but eventually Jesus shows up, and even as Jesus walked this earth, did the apostles fully understand the plan? No. No, still hidden, right? But then the apostles come along, and they begin to preach, and they're in Pentecost. As Peter begins to preach, does Peter entirely understand the plan? No. And you know that because Peter, in Acts chapter 2, preached that all mankind could be saved through Christ. If you read in Acts chapter 2, and you get down to about 38, 39, and 40 in the chapter, he talks about who would be saved through baptism. You repent and be baptized. And he says, this promise is for you and for your children and for all who are far off. Guess who the far off are? They're the Gentiles. Peter didn't know that. Because Peter would later on be asked in Acts chapter 10 to go preach to Cornelius. And he'd go, I shouldn't go there. I'm not supposed to talk to Gentiles. But now you and I, today, here in 2018, as we still have a couple more months of it, talking on the phone with somebody, and they said it was 2019, and I scolded them. I said, no, I've got a couple months left. 2018, here in 2018, you have the total knowledge that's been brought to light. And yet, even today, even though you have it totally available, when you read your Bible, it talks about it as a kingdom that has constantly been described as hidden. Think about the parable in Matthew chapter 13, verse 44. The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field. That's not just something for back in the Old Testament. Today, it's still a treasure hidden in a field. That is, the man comes along and he's walking through the field and he comes across this treasure and he wasn't expecting it and it totally caught him off guard, but he sees the value of it and he sells everything he has to buy the field. Does that still happen to people today where they weren't looking for Christianity, they weren't searching for it, and yet somehow, providentially, they stumble across it? That was me. In some ways, I could say I was searching, but in other ways, I didn't know anything of what I was searching for. And yet, one day, I ran into the right person at the right time, and she said, you know, I'm going to heaven, and you're not. And I thought, ha, that's something interesting. Let me look a little closer. It's hidden today just as much as it was back then. Matthew chapter 13, verse 33 describes it as a hidden leaven that you put into people's lives. And what does leaven do? You can't really see it, but it changes things internally. If you really want to see the gospel make an impact in your life, you got to give it time. It won't change your whole life in a moment. It won't change it in a day or a week or even a month. But you begin to give years of commitment to the Lord, and you will look back 5 years, 10 years, 15 years later, and you will not even recognize the person that you were before you committed your life to Christ. And it works in unseen and hidden ways, just like leaven does. It's just like leaven is kind of like the magic of baking. So too, Christianity is the magic of the soul that takes the dead and makes them alive. And 1 Corinthians chapter 2 describes it as hidden wisdom. Wisdom that doesn't make sense to most people. Because most of Christianity is entirely nonsensical if you're an academic elite. The academic elites look at this book and they go, well, that's a very interesting document written by people who were really old and foolish and ancient people who didn't know the things that we know today. Now that we know what we do about science and psychology, we know better. All of you people who've been spanking your children have been abusing them. Think about that for a second. Just that one simple idea that is a very modern idea, that to discipline your children, I'm not talking about beating or violence or anything like that, but I mean spanking your children and discipline. It's a modern idea that is foolishness. Modern academics come up with this idea that no, only positive reinforcement, right? If that is true, that you will ruin your child with negative reinforcement, how did we ever make it to the point we're at right now? Because guess what people have been doing for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years? They've been spanking their kids. And they didn't all turn into axe murderers and serial killers. But if you're an academic elite, we know better. In 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 4 and 5, it says, my message and my preaching were not in persuasive words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, so that your faith would not rest on the wisdom of men, but on the power of God. One of the things that Jesus found so beautiful about the gospel is something that you and I need to also find beautiful about the gospel, right? When Jesus, the Son of God of Nazareth, comes along and he looks at something and he says, isn't that beautiful? And then hands it to you so you can see the beauty too. Do you take a moment to stare at it? Because that's what he's doing in Matthew chapter 11. He's handing something to us and saying, hey, do you realize this is a beautiful thing that God did, right? And every once in a while I get a chance to go hiking with Daniel Reeves, and Daniel loves all natural things, and he's got an eye for seeing things that I don't see. And so every once in a while he'll tell me, hey, Scott, come over and look at this thing. And he has an eye for it. And when Daniel, as a naturalist, as somebody who specializes in these sorts of things, says, hey, Scott, you should come over and look at this leaf, a leaf that I would have walked right on past because Daniel said, look at it, what do? I stop for a second and I look at it because Daniel probably sees something that I've just missed. It's not that it's not there. I just missed it. That's what Jesus is saying about the gospel. He's saying the fact that God hid it from the wise and the intelligent world is a beautiful thing. One, it's beautiful because that means that you don't have to be steeped in the things of the world in order to understand it, right? And two, when Paul came along, and as he says here in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, and he says, I didn't come with a message of persuasive words, and it still affected the world, didn't it? Did Paul turn the world upside down? That's what even his enemies said. He turned the world upside down with his message. And Paul said, I didn't come with a persuasive, eloquent message. If it worked for Paul, it'll work for us too, right? We don't have to have every little T crossed and I dotted in terms of the smoothness of our speech as we share the gospel, because we don't have to come across as the wise and intelligent academic elite. Because the people who will respond to the gospel are not going to be those people anyways. He's never going to be those people. Jesus is recognizing the fact that God has crafted the way, the message, the gospel in such a way that it was available to everybody, but most people would miss it. In common, like computer terms today, we'd call it an Easter egg. If you've ever played a video game or maybe looked at certain websites, they call them Easter eggs. It's where there's something in the game or something on the website that's there, and anybody could click on it and everybody could access it, but most people don't even realize it's there and they're not willing to put the work into doing it. That's why back in the day when some of the first video game consoles came out, every teenage boy knew, it was like left, right, left. There was this code to... Yeah, see, he just said it under his breath, right? Yeah, we knew it by heart. Now, our parents didn't know it, and the other people living their real lives didn't know it, but all of us, we knew it by heart, how to get these cheat codes into video games, and it was always there, but we were the only ones who cared enough to search it out. Guess what the gospel is? It's available to everybody. Anybody can become a Christian. There's nobody that God's holding back saying, no, not you, I don't want you in. He wants all people in. But who will not waste their time with searching through the boring, rudimentary, ancient teachings of fishermen? The wise and intelligent in this world, they have no time or interest for it. But if you and I will delve into it and begin to read it, here's this book that can change anybody's life, and it does. Jesus found it a beautiful thing that God, by the very nature of how he made the gospel, simply saved our time. Think about it if he had done it differently for a second. If God had done it differently, then the church would be full of the academic elite who had their own ideas, and how quickly would that cause problems in congregations? I'll tell you what, I'm glad that the modern ideas of the world simply don't even find the church of interest, because I don't want to have to deal with it. Let it be out there. Let those sorts of temptations and ridiculousness of man's wisdom be out there. Don't let it infiltrate us. We just want the simple gospel. And they find that anathema. In 1 Corinthians chapter 2, after those verses that we looked at before, he continues on. He says, but we impart a secret and hidden wisdom of God, which God decreed before the ages for our glory. None of the rulers of this age understood this. For if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. But as it is written, what no eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor the heart of man imagined, what God has prepared for those who love him. I have a couple of friends that we've known for years, and they met on an online dating site back when that was still a pretty new thing, and it raised most people's eyebrows that they met that way. And so they did everything essentially wrong, right? All the things that they tell you today, which is make sure that you know what they look like and that they're a real person, and that they're not some guy in their basement with a beard. You know, all of those different things. They didn't do any of that. They just talked. And so they talked online in the email back and forth. And then eventually they decided it was time to meet. And so this wonderful couple that my wife and I adore and have known for years, they met each other, and she walked off of the airplane, and he was there holding a sign for her, and she is a tall woman. She is almost my height, and not small. He is a very tiny man. He is about Jenna's height. She might be taller than him. And slight. So imagine for a second, they've been talking and getting to know each other and knowing each other's hearts and getting to know the kind of people they are. And so she walks off the plane, and here she is, and he's holding a sign. And there was a moment, and they both tell this story this way. They said there was a moment where they both looked at each other, and they go, oh. And then you have to make a decision, don't you, right? At that moment, you have to make a decision. Okay, am I in because I know who this person is and we've talked? Or is this going to be too much of a barrier and I'm out? And thankfully, they both said they were in. And they are now happily married, and they're great people, and they both love the Lord, and they've done a lot of good. And they've had a really, truly magical life because they were able to look past something that many other people wouldn't have the maturity to look past. What happens when we don't do what the rulers of this age did, where they said, we know what we're doing and we don't need any of this teaching from God? What the wise and the intelligent, the rulers, the scribes, the Pharisees, the debaters of the age did, where they said, I've got this figured out. I'm a great teacher. Who needs anything new? And they condescended to God. They missed out on what 1 Corinthians 2, Paul describes as what no eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor the heart of man imagined, what God has prepared for those who love him. You realize that if you will let go of that and not be like the wise and intelligent of the world, but we will come with humility in our hearts to God, you get to see things you would never imagine. There's a life awaiting you that you would never imagine. Just like that couple there, and she walks off the plane, and if she had gotten right back on the plane, and many people would, there's a whole life, decades of marriage they would have missed out on. So many joys and tears and memories and things that they had no clue about, but because they said, okay, they got to enjoy all of those things. It is that way with Christianity. If we will accept it for what it is, the wisdom of God given to us as children, then we can see some really beautiful things. Which brings us to the second point, which is he says that you've hidden these things from the wise and intelligent, and then he says you've revealed them to infants. Mark chapter 10, verse 15, Jesus said, truly I say to you, whoever does not receive the kingdom of God like a child shall not enter it. There is a simple truth that we must have a childlike attitude in order to enter the kingdom. That's the only people that it will ever be revealed to. If you don't think like a kid, you're going to miss it. Well, what part of being a kid? Is it the part of you that throws temper tantrums? Is that what he's looking for? When he says, the kingdom of God is, you got to receive it like a child, is he saying you need to be bratty like a little kid can be? Or maybe not prefer to share things? Well, what aspect of being a child is it? Maybe you're a picky eater. Is that what it is? No, of course not. It's none of those things. Matthew 18 clarifies it. Whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Kids have an awful lot of things to learn on this planet. And in fact, the Psalms and the Proverbs, when they talk about children, it says that they have foolishness bound up in their heart. Kids don't know anything. But you know what? They are very, very good at accepting that they don't know anything. And they're entirely helpless, but they're very, very good at recognizing that helplessness and asking other people to help them. You think about how hard it is for us as adults to ask help of other adults. It is oftentimes one of the hardest things for us to do is to say, you know, here's a thing and I need help with it and I just have to ask. We're awful at it. I am absolutely the worst. I just got done painting my house, and there's a portion of my house that reaches a height that goes above my ladder. I have about a 25-foot ladder, And at the peak of my house, I'm more like 30 feet, something like that. So my ladder doesn't quite get to the peak. And Jenna came back one day and said, hey, by the way, Mike Simmons, he offered you his ladder. He's got a 32-foot ladder. You would think that that would be the simplest thing in the world for me to go, well, my house is 30 feet. I need a 32-foot ladder. I should say yes. I drug my feet. In fact, I even took my ladder out, took it out to the peak, took it up, and then I climbed all the way to the top, and I thought, can I reach? Not enough life insurance. And I went through this whole process of, can I do it without getting that ladder? Why? Because I'm a stupid guy. Because I'm not as humble as I ought to be. Because that's an entirely human and reprehensible trait of me. That's the truth. Kids don't have that problem. If kids want something and you have that thing, guess what they do? Can I have that thing? They have no problem asking. And they also have no problem asking. You say no, that doesn't mean that they'll stop asking the next time either. They'll ask again the next time. This is why I eat dessert in private, right? Because my kids want to know, well, what is it you're eating and why? And does it taste good? No, I'm eating it because it's awful. I mean, children are very good at reaching out and saying, I don't have, you have, could you help? And that's a humility that they're born with. And if you and I are going to be children of the King, we've got to find that again. And God finds that beautiful when you do. In James chapter 4, verses 5 and 6, it says, do you suppose it is no purpose that the Scripture says he yearns jealously over the Spirit that he's made to dwell in us? But he gives more grace. Therefore, it says, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. How many stories in the Bible, if you were to begin to kind of count up in your mind's eye the stories that you've read about somebody who was proud in the Bible and then got themselves in trouble? Quite a few, right? And then you begin to think about how many stories are there in the Bible of people who finally, when they got buckled and at the absolute darkest hour of their life, their knees were buckled, they turned to God and they asked for help, and when things were as dark as possible, he provided for their need when they simply asked. You know what Jesus found well-pleasing about the way? Is that it was a way that somebody with a broken and contrite spirit could find. The barrier of entry wasn't you have to be this smart to get in. The barrier of entry is you have to need it enough. If you really need it enough, if you really are broken enough and you realize your problems and your sin and your struggles enough, then you're ready. And that's a beautiful thing. In Ephesians 2, verse 8, for by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not your own doing. It is the gift of God, not a result of works, that no one may boast. The one thing that you and I are told that we are not allowed to do when talking our salvation and discussing it, the one thing we're never allowed to say is how much we've done to earn it. The one thing you and I have to recognize is that it is a gift and a blessing from God, and that requires childlike humility. The barrier to entry for Christianity that Jesus saw was not the greatness of man, but the willingness of a human being to recognize how low they were. And I'll tell you what, if you tell me, Scott, you need to be one of the smartest guys, fastest guys, strongest guys on the planet, I'm going to say that's beyond my ability. There's lots of guys smarter, faster, stronger than me, and that ship has sailed. It's like me watching the Olympics. Too late, right? But if you say, Scott, in order to really get the most out of the Bible, you've got to take yourself down a few pegs and count up the things that you're not good at. Hey, I can do that one. I may not like to do that one. It may not be enjoyable for me to do, but I can do it. I can examine myself and find myself in myself the things that are wanting. And Jesus said, I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you have hidden these things from the wise and intelligent and have revealed them to infants. Yes, Father, for this way was well-pleasing in your sight. Jesus says that he had revealed them to infants. And in Matthew chapter 11, the next two verses, he'll go on to say, All things have been handed over to me by my Father, and no one knows the Son except the Father, nor does anyone know the Father except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son wills to reveal him. Well, think about it. He's just answered that question. Who does the Son will to reveal the Father to? Reveal him to infants, right? To those who are humble of heart. Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. Christianity is a beautiful thing. And the fact of the matter is the reason that most people are not interested in the narrow gate is not because it's not available to them, but because most of us are too busy trying to prove how great we are to do the thing that is the one thing that's required of us, which is to recognize that we're not as great as we think we are and that we need help. But if you can do that with yourself, if you can begin to count up the things in your life and in your soul that are wanting and lacking, then all of a sudden he says, take my yoke upon you and learn from me. I'm gentle and humble in heart, and you'll find rest for your souls. If we stop trying to whitewash the tombs and say everything's okay, but instead recognize, no, it's not okay. And we don't live in a planet where things are okay. Heaven is where things will be okay. Here is where things are hard. And where I don't live as I ought to do, and I don't make the choices that I ought to, and I have problems that I don't always have a good answer for. If we'll do that, he says, take my yoke upon you, and you will then have rest for your souls. That's the beautiful, well-pleasing way of the Lord. The invitation song is number 287. There's a fountain free. It's the gift of God, the salvation that he has offered. If you are ready to become a Christian, have to do is recognize the need, right? You have a sin problem, and it's one that's not going away. Your soul is dead without that sin being wiped clean and forgiven, and it can't be done by you, because no matter how many great things you do, it'll never undo the bad things you've done. But there is a Savior who you could be washed in his blood. And if you're ready to be baptized so that that would happen, so that you come out of that water with your sins washed away, there's a fountain free. It's available for all. If we can help you to do that, please come forward as we stand and sing number 287.